Sunday evening here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. Your Legal Rights is next on KALW. Tonight's topic is driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs law and issues. Chuck Finney's guests are San Mateo County Deputy District Attorney Michael Wendler, Criminal Defense Attorney Jeffrey Carr, and California Highway Patrol Officer Kevin Walsh. If you have a question for Chuck and his guests, please call 841-4134. That's 841-4134, 415-841-4134. Now, here's your legal rights.
This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of Your Legal Rights, we're going to be talking about driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs, the laws and issues. My guests are San Mateo County Deputy District Attorney Michael Wendler, Criminal Defense Attorney Jeffrey Carr, his office is in Redwood City, and California Highway Patrol Officer Kevin Walsh out of the CHP office in Redwood City. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the San Mateo County Bar Association. It's the only bar association in the country that provides private defender services for indigent criminal defendants. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. What we're going to do is have some very brief summaries by my guests, and then we'll talk about a number of the issues, and a little later in the program, we'll take some calls. Those of you who listen to the full hour of the program will have a chance to certainly call in and pose your question. We won't know who you are, so if you have a question that really is really critically important to you, certainly feel comfortable to call in. For those of you who are wondering, when will we do our next Call a Lawyer Night? It will be 2 weeks from now. That'll be Wednesday, January 25th. You might want to jot down the number where you can talk to attorneys off the air. No obligations whatsoever. 1-800-525-9917. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me. Really nice to have you here. Michael, would you do this? Could you kind of initially summarize how do you view your role as a deputy DA when you're dealing with a driving under the influence case?
Well, Chuck, first, thank you for having us here. I'm very familiar with all the panelists, and I'm excited to be invited as a guest. I'm quite familiar with the show and your long list, a distinguished list of panelists. As for Jeff Carr, I've known him for over 6 years now, and he's definitely one of the best defense attorneys I know. He's extremely knowledgeable about driving under the influence cases and is very effective at court. He's a great guy and fun to be with, and a DA better be on the best game when they're going up against Jeff Carr. Kevin Walsh from Highway Patrol is someone that we work closely with in the district attorney's office. He's definitely one of the most respected Highway Patrol officers by prosecutors and defense attorneys, and he works hard and is a great guy to be around. Mm-hmm. So I'm honored to be here. It's a little frustrating. For the first time in my life, I'm the best-looking guy in the room.
And it's, oh, really? Okay.
And it's on the radio.
In your dreams, Mark.
You do have a face for radio.
That's what I've been told. True. People have been complimenting me on that all day. After all, I wore my best suit.
You look great.
Thank you.
You look really great.
Put on my best cologne and even got makeup tips from Dean Johnson. But I guess all that's for naught. An introduction about driving under the influence cases from the perspective of a deputy DA. The first rule we have is when a local agency presents us with the police report and submits it to us to review for filing. And I have to say first, every single case is different, and I think Jeff would agree with me on that. We look for different things, and I've never seen the same case twice. Mm-hmm. So we first look at the case. Obviously, we look at the manner of driving, a drinking pattern that the suspect gave to the officer, and of course, a blood alcohol content or through breath. Mm-hmm. Those are the main things we look at.
When you say drinking pattern, what do you mean by that?
An officer, especially a Highway Patrol, will always ask a standard of questions from a suspect after they've been pulled over, and the officer suspects them of driving under the influence. Everything from when they last slept, if they have any physical disabilities, when they last ate, and when they started drinking, and when they stop drinking.
Now, can a driver under these circumstances, with these kind of questions coming at the driver, refuse to answer saying, well, I have my right to remain silent?
Yes, they can refuse to answer. Of course, the answer we hear most commonly is two beers.
That's true.
What the blood alcohol?
That's what I had before I came over.
I had none. So that's the first thing that we look at. And typically, we could get anywhere as a single DA, anywhere between probably about 10 a week of just DUIs alone.
When you say 10 a week, you mean you're in court on 10?
No, I'm sorry. Each DA will get at least 10 cases to review a week.
To review and prepare a complaint, et cetera?
Exactly. Determine if we're going to file or not.
I see.
The other thing we do is we work with the local police agencies. Obviously, California Highway Patrol is the experts on DUIs as police agencies go. They're they're the experts out there mm-hmm. on how to conduct field sobriety tests. Mm-hmm. However, we will work with them and let them know what works best in court, what juries like, mm-hmm. and what defense attorneys will attack. Mm-hmm. So when they're out there, they could use those skills in addition to their excellent training that they get mm-hmm. in Sacramento mm-hmm. And determine if someone's under the influence. And Highway Patrol has a great reputation if someone's not under the influence. And after they do their field sobriety test, obviously, they let them go.
Let me come to you, Jeff. If you would summarize how you see your role. Obviously, your role is to try to get your client off. Well, or to do the best job you can.
Yeah, getting people off is one of the ways to put it. I think the best way to look at what a defense lawyer does is to ensure that the prosecution has sufficient admissible evidence to prove a client's guilt. We're guided by the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution. We have a lot of ethical requirements as to how we behave. It's sometimes misportrayed in the media as being technicalities and things mm-hmm. of that nature, when in fact our very job is guaranteed by one of the founding documents, one of the most important founding documents of our country. So my role, once Mike and his office files a complaint in any case, but particularly in a DUI, if someone comes to me, is to analyze the elements of the offense and whether the prosecution has sufficient evidence to prove them. And there are a lot more sophisticated or nuanced issues. We were talking before the show here, Mike and Kevin and I, who, by the way, are wonderful guys. If you ever want to get busted, Kevin's the guy you want to get busted.
I'll remember that. Let me write that down yeah. carefully. Yeah.
Call
directly.
Exactly.
Get me Kevin, please.
That's right. I'm driving under the influence. Could you please send Kevin Walsh out to bust me?
Now, my boss may be listening. They don't want me as a prosecutor. Right?
Well, no, apparently not.
Okay.
In any event, then my job is to see that. And there's more nuance. A lot of people in the public don't realize that the numbers are important. But the way the numbers relate to the time of driving and the alcohol level at the time of driving and the charging policies of a particular DA's office are all important considerations. And there are more defenses than are dreamed of in your science, Horatio, often, and then often not. And what I try to do as a defense lawyer is when people come to me, I don't even take a case until I've had a chance to look at the police reports, which a lot of people think I can get or they can get from the police department or the CHP, and Kevin can remind them that they can't. Mm-hmm. That has to be in California through the DA's office. And then I get that, and then we talk about what the case looks like and talk about what the defenses might be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Kevin, let me ask you this. I mentioned this to Michael just a couple of minutes ago. If you suspect that someone is driving under the influence and you're on the freeway,
yes,
and you pull this person over, and this person is somewhat not necessarily obnoxious, but says, "Officer, I have the right to remain silent. Do I not, with regard to the questions you're asking me?" And you will say what?
You do.
And so, what happens then? If someone you suspect this person is intoxicated. When the person says, I have the right under the Miranda law not to answer your questions, how do you deal with somebody like that?
Well, before we make a determination whether or not to make an arrest, we take in the totality of the entire circumstance. The driving, the behavior, the physical observations an officer makes of the person's demeanor, gait, walking to and from the car. So if he refuses to answer questions, which he's he's completely within his rights to do so, then we'll make our determination based on what we've observed to that point.
Do you have the authority, if someone says, "Your officer, I'm not going to speak to you," do you have the authority to require that the person walk a certain number of steps?
You can.
And you observe the person? Do you have the right to do that?
I can request that he submit to certain field sobriety tests, mm-hmm. but he does not have to submit to them. And then we have to make our determination based on what we've seen, and mm-hmm. if we're able to articulate it well enough, we can still make an arrest without those things mm-hmm. existing.
Do you find that many people are saying, "Officer, I don't want to talk to you"?
Not typically.
Really? Okay. Typically. Most people are fairly cooperative?
Well, because if they limit the amount of information that we have,
yeah.
they limit their chances of driving home.
I see.
That's the way I look at it.
Driving home on their own.
Exactly.
From a defense,
they could get a little bit of chauffeured driving.
They could get chauffeured driving home. But from a defense point of view, people talk too much. that they think they're going to talk their way out of it. And the Fifth Amendment guarantees you the right not to speak to the police. An interesting nuance that Kevin alluded to a little bit is that the police do not have to advise you of your rights mm-hmm. until, in a DUI context, the point of arrest, is after field sobriety testing and general questioning. Mm-hmm. A lot of clients come to me saying, well, they didn't read me my Miranda rights. Well, it doesn't matter until mm-hmm. the arrest occurred. And almost all police officers, particularly CHP, are trained that from the point the cuffs go on or the person's detained in any significant way, they know that that's when the Miranda admonition needs to be given. Up to that point, the police ask questions, CHP asks questions, and one of the largest problems I see is people tend to want to tell an officer they stopped drinking at Easter last year when the statistics show that about 90% of DUIs occur within 15 to 30 minutes of termination of drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And what people don't know is that the worst thing to tell a police officer is to lie about, I drank a lot earlier, because if you have a pretty low blood alcohol and you really did stop 15 minutes earlier and you have an 08 or something like that, the DAs and all of us know that means at the time of the driving, your blood alcohol may have been quite a bit lower. Mm-hmm. But people sabotage themselves by thinking it's better if I told them I stopped drinking at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and the bust is at midnight. Mm. So
in the law, the vehicle code, it's if you have a blood alcohol which is over 0.08, this is something that you're in violation of the vehicle code. Is that right, Michael?
There's actually two vehicle codes, not to bore him, but it's 23-152A and mm-hmm. 23-152B. A, it says that it's against the law to drive under the influence. Now, that could be drugs or alcohol. Mm-hmm. The standard is there to prove that case beyond a reasonable doubt. We do not need a chemical test. Obviously, that helps, but we don't need a chemical test. The standard for that is something along the lines, if a person is not driving in the manner of a sober person because of drugs or because of alcohol, then they're guilty of that section.
Mm-hmm.
Now, drugs, it does not matter if you're legally prescribed the drugs or not. If you're legally prescribed drugs and they affect you to the point that you're not operating your vehicle in the manner of a sober person, you can still be found guilty of that charge. The second count that people normally see is violation of 23-152 subsection B, which says it's illegal for 0.08 or above. So if you're at a 0.08, you still could be found guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And as Jeff referenced earlier, it's at the time of driving, not at the time of the test. So if I prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the person's blood alcohol or breath alcohol content was a 0.08 at the time of driving, then they will be found guilty of the second count.
But you're saying at the time of the test. Now, the time of the test may be, for example, Kevin, if you're following someone and this person is kind of wobbling in the lane and maybe going over the white line or whatever it may be, and by the time you give a test, it may be several minutes down the road. Maybe it could be at least 15 minutes. This person may have stopped drinking perhaps half an hour ago.
Right.
How do you deal with somebody like that? And obviously, help us if you would, for those of us who fortunately have not had the experience of dealing with you before. does not the blood alcohol level actually, as the body is assimilating the alcohol, increase up to a certain point and then start to drop down? And how do you deal with that if, for example, someone stopped drinking half an hour before and maybe it was only 2 or 3 beers?
I think that that situation is typically best left for a courtroom.
Yes.
For the attorneys to decide if it was if the blood alcohol was on the way up or on the way down.
Yes.
In the field, you're dealing with what you have right in front of you. If say the person, I believed him to be an 08 at the time of right there in the field, and he said, "Well, I just, you know, had a drink 5-10 minutes ago." Well, in order to address that, that's why our investigation, our field investigations typically take in excess of 15 minutes.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So we kind of try to deal with that situation of a rising curve at the time of driving.
Mm-hmm.
But anything beyond that is probably more an issue for trial, mm-hmm. for the attorneys to make their argument for a rising or falling blood alcohol.
Jeff, is that a big thing that you try to pursue?
Sure. I mean, that's a common defense. Some DAs belittle it as some sort of...
Misto magic?
Exactly. And in fact, it happens to be metabolically true. Your blood alcohol level doesn't stay stable for very long. It's either going up or coming down. And those things are the meat upon which the prosecution and defense pound out our cases. One of the interesting things locally, and Kevin may be able to speak to this, is that in Santa Clara County, often the DA's policy is to request field sobriety tests to be done once in the field, and then at the time of the chemical test done, once the person is arrested. It isn't as uniformly followed now as it was 10 or 15 years ago. But that's a way of DAs trying to cope with that issue, which is, well, let's see if his improvement or her performance on field sobriety tests improved or got worse.
Mm-hmm.
And then that would tend to be circumstantial evidence of rising or falling blood alcohol, mm-hmm. which I think... And I've always advocated to DAs that, well, listen, that's a good thing to do.
What?
Is to, yes, that would not be Mike, is to have the officers do field sobriety tests right after the person gets out of the car. But then when they do a test, which can be longer even than Kevin and I were talking.
More than 15 minutes.
It can be an hour.
Yeah.
And then do it again there, because then you get a feel, both sides get a feel, was this person improving in terms of their performance or not, and then that's circumstantial evidence that both sides would be interested in. Right, Kevin?
The test, Kevin, would be what? What kind of test would you get?
The typical field sobriety test?
Yes.
There's the battery, the standard battery that we use, which is horizontal gaze nystagmus.
That's a lovely term. You might want to describe that.
Yeah, this is looking into their eyes. Right?
Yeah,
look at me in my eyes.
Look at me in my eyes.
Yeah,
follow a stimulus as smoothly as you can, and then we observe certain behaviors in their eyes. And then there is the walk and turn, which most people have seen on TV, is walking a straight line. And then the one-legged stand. Those are the standard battery. And then we have other that are scientifically validated. And then we have other tests that we use that I think are just as telling, but not scientifically validated. Most officers do in the vicinity of about 5 field sobriety tests, and that includes the handheld preliminary alcohol screening device, which we call a PASS.
And what is that when you say a PASS? What is the driver who you stop supposed to do with a PASS?
Well, it's like any other field sobriety test. They don't have to submit to it if they.
Let's say
want.
They do. What happens?
We give them a standard admonition that this is you have the right to refuse, and that this is not a chemical test, which is required of them if they are arrested for DUI. This is just a field sobriety test, and it helps us to determine if people are safe to drive home. And if they agree to take that test, then we would request that they submit 2 breath samples, a certain
amount. So they blow into something? Is that the idea?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get 2 samples, and if they're within a range of each other, then we would go forward from that point.
So if you get someone who blows into the PASS tester,
mm-hmm.
and that turns out to be a point, does it come up as points like 0.07 or 0.06 or 0.08 or 0.09? How does it?
It goes,
how does it show itself to you?
It actually goes out to the thousands plate. So it would be a point, for instance, a 0.085 or a 0.1 or 0.096 or whatever it is.
I see.
It goes out to the third decimal place.
And so if you see one that is 0.065, what do you do with that?
Well, I would have to... Officers up to the point of the PASS test have already made their evaluations, and the PASS test is used to either confirm or deny their suspicions.
I see. Okay.
So if someone is showing severe impairment and they come up as an 06 in the PASS, it's very useful. Then it makes me think, well, okay, there's something else on board, probably possible prescription medication or other illicit drug that could be involved, or maybe there's a medical issue or, you know, something else is involved here other than just alcohol.
I think it's very important that you discuss what the sanctions may be, what a fine may be if someone is convicted first time, second time, if you would, Michael, because I think people really need to know how severe this can be.
Sure, the consequences for driving under the influence obviously vary greatly. For first, I can only speak for my experience in San Mateo County. For the first offense, there is a fine that's imposed by the court, and that could range probably in the ballpark of $1,700. Then you have to worry about jail costs. If you want to do something on the sheriff's work program, which is like making trash, they're going to charge you for that. DMV is going to cost for your license to get back. You have to pay for the first offender program, a series of classes that DMV will require you to do. That costs money. And you'll have a suspended license for a period of time. And, of course, there's the greatest danger of all, the possible consequence of hurting yourself or hurting others.
Of course.
And that's obviously the greatest consequence of driving under the influence. For a second offense, in our county, it can range anywhere. Again, every single case is different. But it can range anywhere from 30 to 60 days is the standard.
In jail.
And increased fines. And also you have to do the multiple offender program, which is the 9-month program, and that's going to cost a lot of money. And, of course, the suspended license. If you get caught driving on a suspended license and it's suspended because you have a driver under the influence conviction, that carries 10 days minimum jail. Mm-hmm. You could be driving to the market to get milk, hopefully milk, not beer. Driving to the market to get milk and you get arrested, it's going to be 10 days minimum county
really?
Jail.
Wow.
So a DUI, they always say, especially if you're going to hire someone as distinguished as Jeff Carr, it's going to cost them the thousands of dollars.
Well, one thing Mike left out inadvertently, I think, on the first offense in this county, there's also 2 days.
County jail.
County jail. All of these things on the first and second offenses are done doable, mostly. On the sheriff work alternative program, which means the picking up trash part that Mike was talking about. After that, on the third and fourth offenses, things go up and those kinds of alternatives are no longer available.
And a fourth DUI within 10 years is going to be a felony and you're facing prison time at that point. And also, if you have a .15 or above in our county, that's going to add an additional 2 days of county jail.
All right. What about someone who's under 21? I know that the rules, the vehicle code is somewhat different about that in terms of what the blood alcohol can be. Kevin, how do you deal with somebody who's under 21? And I guess there's even a difference if you're under 18.
That's correct. In the age span between 18 and under 21, if you're found with a blood alcohol content that's below an 0.08 but is above an 0.05, there's a different charging section. And then the DMV also has a zero tolerance as far as those situations, and that's an automatic suspension.
What does that mean by zero tolerance?
They can't have any alcohol in your system if you're under 21.
And if you are found to have some alcohol in your system, your license is taken away?
Yes.
For how long?
Roughly, I think it's for under 21, I believe it's a year.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very serious.
And you can also lose your car for that evening. It's not seized in any way, but it will be impounded.
Well, in terms of the protection for the public as well as the person who's found to have been, have some alcohol in his or her blood.
And that's a good point, too. For an adult, a lot of times people feel that it's in their best interest not to provide a breath or blood sample, which they are required to do, called implied consent in California. And if they do that to get out of a DUI, DMV will automatically suspend their license for a year.
Really?
And it's
that's very important to know.
And it's an additional, what we call special allegation, that we could add to the driver under the influence charge, and we can still proceed based on the officer's observations of the driving, a drinking pattern established by the suspect, and performance on field sobriety tests.
So you're saying, Michael, let me make sure I have this clarified. If someone takes the position that he or she has a right to remain silent, I'm protected by the Fifth Amendment, and does not want to take the PASS test, for example?
The pass test, they do not have to take, and there will be no consequences.
Okay, but what test do they have to take if they and they refuse to do it, where the consequences are serious?
They'll take them in San Mateo County. The officer, if they have probable cause to believe someone's driving under the influence, will give them one or two options. First one's a Draeger instrument. It's measures, you know, breath alcohol. And then one is a blood test, where a phlebotomist will come and give a blood test. They are required under California law to give one of those two samples. If they refuse, then their license is suspended, and we could even charge them with an allegation of refusing a chemical test, which will add penalty if they're found guilty.
And how long will the license be suspended again?
I believe it's 1 year automatic suspension.
Wow. So that's pretty significant. Kellen.
And an additional point on that, in San Mateo County, and this is based on county to county, it's different throughout the state, but in this county we have a non-consensual blood test program. So if someone is found to be under the influence of alcohol or drugs, and they were arrested for that, and they refuse to provide any kind of chemical test, we can force them to take a blood test. And it usually doesn't arise to that situation, but initially, it's confusing at first because not many people are aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
But if we have to, we.
Where would the blood test be given? Out there on the highway, out there on the freeway, or back in the jail or wherever?
At our station.
At your station.
And, you know, we get a controlled, clean environment and lay down a mat. And hopefully it doesn't come to that. But if that need be, we hold the person down and the phlebotomist will take a sample of their blood.
So what you're talking about is San Mateo County.
Correct.
What's the situation, if you know, for the rest of the
state?
That's
highway patrol policy.
That's highway. Oh, so that's throughout the state.
Well, that it has to be in coordination with the DA. The DA has to be on board whatever county you're in.
All right.
So it's different from county to
county. And the defense is never on board with that. There's a statutory scheme. The argument that I've made that gets made is that there's a statutory scheme for the enhanced penalties for refusal that were laid out by the legislature a long time ago. And if you resort to the non-consensual blood draws on routine DUIs, that's a violation of the intended policy, and then we argue Fourth Amendment violation. Generally, the ones that are above board and can't be challenged are if there's an accident, felony DUI, mm-hmm. if a person has a lot of priors, and that really is a case-by-case determination as to whether a non-consensual blood draw is admissible. The law is not abundantly clear on it, but the breakpoint often is judge to judge on whether or not it was something other than a standard first offense case. For example, DUI with injury or death.
Mm-hmm.
It only took us 25 minutes to disagree, which is pretty good.
That's not bad.
That's not bad. Yeah,
usually
not bad.
We do it in 30 or 40 seconds.
I bit my tongue earlier.
Yeah. What we're going to do now, we've come to the end of the statewide version of the program, which we record and send out by CD to a number of stations in California. For those of you however, are listening to us live in the Bay Area or live on the internet at www.klw.org, we will continue for another half hour, and you'll have a chance to call in. All right. It is just about 7:27 at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program of discussion about driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs, the laws and the issues involved. I've got some very good guests here who are very knowledgeable about this, and I want to invite you to call in, ask a question, make a comment if you wish, have a chance to chat with my guests. California Highway Patrol Officer Kevin Walsh. How long have you been doing this, Kevin, being a CHP officer?
10 years.
My other two guests are Jeff Carr, who's a very well-renowned criminal defense attorney in San Mateo County, and one of the persons who we share the same DA's general office. By that, we're both employed by Steve Wagstaff of the San Mateo County DA's office. My other guest is Michael Wendler, Deputy DA. So if you would like to call in, a lot of people want to talk to you, and we'll get to you in just a minute or so. By the way, pardon me, while we're waiting to take our first call, I just want to remind you, those of you who are familiar with the program, have been loyal in terms of our Call a Lawyer Night, which we're, by the way, going to do again on January 25th, two weeks from tonight, where you can talk with attorneys off the air, certified specialists in a variety of areas, and other attorneys who are members of the San Mateo County Bar as well as the San Francisco Bar. Alice O'Sullivan, who you may recognize the name, is a former chair of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. She's a certified specialist in workers' comp. She's become a very good watercolor artist. And in her generosity of exhibiting her work at a gallery in Oakland, she has made some significant contributions to KALW. So I can't let this go. And so, in any event, her work is still being shown at Creative Framing and Gallery, which is in Oakland, 5015 Woodminster Lane in Oakland. So if you're interested in seeing Alice's work, which is very, very good, it is still being shown there. And that number, 510-482-1200, 510-482-1200, if you're interested. And if you go so far as buying one of her works, she will make a donation to the station. So I thank Alice very much for doing that. All right, Steve, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Great program, especially coming so quickly after New Year's.
Right.
Eve, of course, which is the amateur night. A good friend of our family, the wife was killed in the husband was very badly injured by a DUI, so it's very sad. Yeah. I've had friends on both sides. In fact, I wanted to ask your great group over there about the new laws that took effect at the beginning of the year. I think there's an AB 520, which says that people that got it for reckless driving with the DUI, are able now to get their license back in 3 months if they put in ignition lock in there as opposed to 1 year. So that's changing the state law. And then also, I think the one guy said the fourth time is a 10-year. I think that changed also. The third time now is possibly a 10-year, right?
No, I believe, and I know Jim Fox, our former district attorney in San Mateo County, was very instrumental in this. I believe the license restrictions change. I forget which assemblyman he did it with, but the license restrictions and suspensions will change on your third or fourth DUI. We can only prosecute a prior DUI if it occurred within the 10 years of the offense date of the new DUI, or if a felony had occurred within the last 10 years. So those requirements are still the same for us. And the interlock ignition device is mandatory on a conviction for driving on a suspended license for DUI, and it's usually, at least in San Mateo County, enforced on a second DUI.
The way I read this one was for reckless driving that came about because of the DUI, that they're able to get their license back within 3 months as opposed to 1 year. Is that right?
I know that they can get their licenses back. That's up to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, these people are probably going to drive anyways is part of the problem, right?
Well, no, I know that the laws, thanks to Jim Fox, were actually made stricter for people that were driving under the influence.
And Steve Wagstaff as well.
And Steve Wagstaff, of course, for driving under the influence.
Well, we're going to move on. Thank you, Steve, very much for calling. Any other comments about what Steve brought up here? Jeff?
They're changing those laws about when you can get your license back, how long the suspensions take effect, and interlock. I was just going to say, Kevin's been doing this for 10 years. I've been doing this for 32. I think I've been doing it longer than either of our two other panelists have been alive, almost. But what I've seen in that period of time, they massage these rules every year. And I think the listener is correct as to his interpretation of the newest massage of the law.
Okay. All right. Kevin, anything you want to comment? All right. Let's talk with Mitch. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, hi. I'm calling with a question about the chart that you get with your registration from the DMV. Every time you renew your vehicle registration, there's a basically a chart that shows your blood alcohol content and basically tries to tell you whether or not how many drinks you would have versus your weight to give you an estimate of whether or not you would have impaired driving skills or be legally intoxicated. And I found the chart a little bit difficult to use. I was wondering if anyone could give your listeners an idea of, like, let's say that I have one or two drinks and I weigh 175 pounds. How long would I have to wait before I could safely drive?
Get in the car and start driving.
I'll take that one because it comes up more as a defense issue.
Here's Jeff for you, Mitch.
Yeah. All that stuff that comes from the DMV is somewhat informative, but dangerous to rely on in either direction. The metabolism of alcohol within the human body varies greatly between individuals. It varies between sexes. For women, it varies in relationship to hormonal levels based on ovulation and other things. And to rely on a chart like that that's kind of black and white, you're either really underestimating or potentially overestimating your blood alcohol. The only thing I would use that chart for is a rough idea that it's fairly accurate that don't have any more than that and be driving. It may not mean that you are illegally driving if you go over that because of these metabolic issues, but having done this for a long time and the costs associated with it when people get in trouble with it, I always ask people to err on the side of caution. And so that's what that's good for, is stay within those guidelines, but don't rely on them as being totally accurate.
And the true test, obviously, is make sure you feel safely to operate a car, which is a deadly weapon.
Of course, the fact of the matter is if someone has had too much alcohol to drink, they lose a fair amount of common sense.
Yes, and that is something that comes up at trial a lot. It's called multitasking, which is required when you're driving a vehicle. You're doing more multitasking than you think you are. You're looking in the rearview mirror. You're trying to maintain in your lane, trying to maintain a safe speed. When you drink alcohol, the more you drink, it's going to affect you mentally, and it's going to affect your abilities to do that multitasking. You may be able to drive at a certain speed, but you're not looking at the traffic around you. You're not being prepared for a stop sign.
One of the problems, too, Chuck, is that many people do not feel impaired at 0.08. It's a level that catches, and there's lots of scientific dispute and legal dispute that we could get into that we shouldn't, but the problem is you can be a 0.08 and feel perfectly fine, and you may not be violating 23-152A, which is the general DUI statute that Mike talked about, but if your blood alcohol is over a 0.08 at the time of the driving, you're still violating 23-152B. Mm-hmm. So the danger is, at that level, many people don't feel intoxicated, so you have to be very careful and give yourself field sobriety tests.
And that's where... And that's where, obviously, the district attorney's office would respectfully disagree with Mr. Carr. And something lawyers just say, respectfully disagree. We would disagree. At an 08, we believe that everybody is mentally impaired.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't even mean that, Mike. That's a different subject. What I meant was you may not believe it.
Yeah.
Whereas at higher blood alcohol levels, I generally use as a rule of thumb, if you're 1.5 or over, everybody knows they're grossly intoxicated. And anything up to about a 1.0, 1.2, many people don't feel it, even though I'm not disagreeing. Many of them, or all of them, that would be our disagreement, would be impaired.
So I think one of the problems I see that you're talking about, Jeff, is that people who perhaps get to an 08, they don't realize that they are impaired.
Correct. Particularly, I find it with smaller individuals, particularly women. Under 100 pounds, they can get to an 08 fairly regularly. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting switch on the old saw that you hold your liquor well, bigger people hold their liquor, et cetera, et cetera. That's not true, because there's a tolerance factor that Mike and I are aware of, and Kevin also, that if you get to a high blood alcohol in two or three drinks, like a young woman might who weighs 90 pounds wet, if she has two glasses of wine or three with her boyfriend at dinner, who weighs 180 or 200 pounds, he's going to be a very low blood alcohol. She's going to be very high, and she's the more experienced drinker in the sense of tolerance, because when she has what we would consider social drinking, her blood alcohol level is much higher than her larger companion.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I think people think an 08 is a high standard. It's really not, from our perspective. The AMA recommends that the
American Medical Association.
Yes, recommends that the law be changed to 05, that everybody is at least somewhat mentally impaired at 05. In fact, you're going to see mental impairment before you see physical impairment.
And that's really what the critical issue is here, I think, the mental impairment, is it not?
Someone might be able to perform decent on field sobriety tests. That could be, as Jeff just stated, because of tolerance. And it's also, but they still may be mentally impaired.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, let's. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs. My guests are criminal defense attorney Jeff Carr, San Mateo County Deputy DA Michael Wendler, and California Highway Patrol Officer Kevin Walsh. Our number is 1-415-841-4134. By the way, I want to remind you again that our Call a Lawyer night will be in 2 weeks on January 25th. If you'd like to join us, I'll be doing a program on landlord-tenant law with the regular people who I have on, James Coy Driscoll and Mark Seidenfeld. And then we will have our conference room with a number of attorneys who you can talk to on our 800 number and who will talk to you without any obligation whatsoever, 1-800-525-9917. But if you'd like to talk to my guests now, it's 1-415-841-4134. And Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Chuck.
You're welcome.
What got me to really totally abstain from driving with just about any alcohol at all.
Well, wait a minute. When I say any alcohol, that sounds like you got some alcohol.
Well, you know,
come on, Dave. Don't pull our leg on this one. Go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
But half a drink, I weigh 250 pounds.
Okay.
Half a drink is not going to put me, I don't think, at risk. But what got me to say half a drink is too much is I asked my attorney, suppose you get pulled over, and you are charged and tried, and you're acquitted. That is, the judge or the jury or whatever decides that you were not, in fact, impaired.
Mm-hmm.
What are your attorney's fees? And his answer for him was $18,000.
Wow.
So, I mean, this is something you really have to take into account. And it certainly puts the light of day on better not.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you've got a very expensive attorney.
Oh, I didn't think so.
Okay,
actually,
yeah.
I think for really experienced counsel through a jury trial, and remember, I think Mike may have talked about it earlier, or maybe we were off mic, but a jury trial, and this isn't like a traffic hearing that takes an hour or two. It's a 3 to 5 day proposition. If it's a jury, and that's the only kind of trial one wants to have from a defense point of view. So you're looking at that. You're looking at expert costs. You're looking at pretrial work. So $15,000 to $20,000 is a relatively average figure through trial for experienced counsel. For less experienced counsel, and I have different, in my office, I have different levels, difference of experience, and we price it out accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
Can be done for less than that. But that's certainly a good thing to remember. For example, when I've been drinking anything and driving, or not driving, hopefully, and thinking about driving, I get a cab because I would not want to have to pay to defend myself.
Wise. It's a lot cheaper.
And more importantly, obviously in that situation, one, I would not have been the prosecutor in that hypothetical with an acquittal. And two, the focus should be not on necessarily attorney fees, but putting the danger or putting the community at risk of driving under the influence.
You know, but Dave, I'm very pleased that you called and you told us what your attorney had told you, because we hadn't really gotten to that. And I think that's really kind of a real eye-opener for people who might want to take the risk or think about taking the risk of drinking and then driving. Thank you very much for calling.
You're
welcome. Glad you did. All right. 1-415-841-4134. Tara, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, Chuck. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Great program.
Thank you.
My question is sort of a holistic one for all of your panelists. And
we haven't had a holistic question.
Wow.
This is good. Oh, boy.
Well,
hold on, fellas.
I left my rainbow decal in the car.
Is this going to be some kind of Stanford-type question?
Are you from Stanford, Tara?
I am a Stanford graduate.
How did we know?
This is too much.
Okay. That has nothing to do with my question.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
You've all been talking about the high cost of DUI, not only to the driver and society, the cost, the legal fees and, you know, court fees and all of the things that can come with a sentence if you're convicted. And my question is, why do you think, setting aside people with alcohol abuse problems for a moment, why aren't more people deterred from committing this crime?
Kevin?
I think because you have a a constant group of people that need education being young drivers. And it's not something that you can get to the point where, okay, everybody knows this. Every year you get a whole new crop of young drivers and they need education as well. And I think that's where you see your biggest offenders and is in younger people.
Thank you. It is interesting. The statistics, MADD, keep Mothers Against Drunk Driving,
yes.
Keeps track of this sort of thing over the years. And what they find is when there are increased penalties, whether relative to your driver's license or to the criminal aspects, and they are two separate aspects, for the first year or two that they're in effect, drivers seem to respond, and then things go down. And then as the years go by, people go back to their old ways, mm-hmm. and then they do some new, more draconian penalty scheme or license, and then people will drop off again. Mm-hmm. In the long term, I think, besides Kevin's cogent point about younger people always coming in, people aren't perfect, and legal systems do not mandate perfection. They can't. And because people are forever frail, whether it's this type of charge or many of the other charges Mike and I and Kevin deal with, people will continue to do things on the belief that they will not be caught.
Yeah.
And that's, I think the reality is, Tara, that is how people think. And I definitely smell what you're stepping in.
Thank you very much, Tara, for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Tara.
Very good. Thanks a lot. All right, Dave, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. My question is in regard to expungements. It was 1990. I got a DUI in New Jersey, and I know this isn't New Jersey, obviously, but I just had like a general question. I went to DMV a couple weeks ago, and I noticed this DUI. It wasn't expressed that way on the form on my driver record, but it did show up. And my question, I guess, is at the time they said, well, after, I don't know, 5 years, it'll disappear. It'll be expunged.
This is what Virginia said?
New Jersey.
I'm sorry, New Jersey said this? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just wondering, should it be expunged or, you know, why am I seeing it?
I'll take this one, I guess, because I deal with this pretty regularly. Mike and Kevin probably don't. There are a couple aspects. First of all, expungement in California, there is no expungement. There's 1203.4, the penal code, that allows you to alleviate some of the effects of penalties in criminal convictions. Frankly, it doesn't really apply in DUIs because they are maintained on your DMV printout for the 10-year charging period of the prior convictions. So it's going to remain there for 10 years, even if you are otherwise eligible to have it, quote, expunged under the penal code. So people ask me this all the time, and I say, what's the point? Because it creates confusion between your alleged criminal history and the DMV history, and all these things in the computer age are available to people immediately online, so prospective employers are going to find this out very quickly. As to your 20-year-old, 21-year-old, that shouldn't be showing up anywhere. An out-of-state conviction from 20 years ago showing up on DMV in California is extremely odd. Mike and Kevin and I are all kind of, we look at this differently, but we're shaking our heads communally. We don't know why that would be. That's a real aberration, frankly.
Yeah, in fact, I'll just say this real quick. It wasn't there 10 years ago, and now it is.
How strange.
That's even stranger.
What most likely is some sort of a foul-up by some clerk putting something in at some point at some stage, because it should have no effect on you at this point in California.
Exactly. Right. Do I have a right to see if I can get that, taken off?
Yeah, you can ask the DMV about it. And unless I was able to look at your DMV printout and see exactly what it's showing up as, I would be really unable to give you.
Where do you live,
advice.
Dave?
San Francisco.
There you, okay. I want you to take down a phone number now.
Sure. Go ahead.
When you're ready. But take it off your radio. Turn your radio back on. I'm going to give it to you. And this relates to everybody who maybe has a question, whether it's about driving under the influence or some other legal problem. And if you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and Dave, here's the phone number. For a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. Since this program, this particular specific episode of Your Legal Rights, is funded by the San Mateo County Bar Association, I want you to know that the Bar Association in San Mateo County also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149. 650-369-4149. And the point of this is that you can call, tell a human being at the Bar Association what the problem is. They'll find someone who's experienced and set you up for a half an hour consultation. And depending on what county you're in, whether it's San Mateo, San Francisco, anywhere in the state, it could be a low for half an hour of $25 or a high of maybe $35 with some exception. And at least you can get some basic information, and you want to find out perhaps if an attorney has had any experience in dealing with the DMV. You would, Dave. Do you have something, Michael, on that?
Yeah, Dave's situation is obviously highly exotic, but when we get cases referred to us for filing, we do get their DMV sheet, and DUIs will only stay on those for 10 years because that's when it's priorable. Yeah. It occurred within 10 years of the
So you probably got something that can be corrected, Dave, but you're going to probably have to go through a few hoops to get it done. But thank you very much for calling, and good luck to you. All right, Anne, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hi. I have a question about public intoxication. What if you are...
You mean you're not in the car? You're not in the car, you're on the sidewalk?
Yes.
Is that walking or lying or what?
Public intoxication.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. Go ahead.
What should you do and what are the penalties?
Are you talking about, okay, all right. If you are, you've been drinking and you're out in the public and you're staggering around and a police officer.
You get arrested and they take you and make you sleep it off. And then they tell you to come back for a hearing. What should you expect?
I'll take this from the district attorney's point of view, and it is going to vary from county to county. The drunk in public statutes are pretty complicated, more complicated than people think. But the requirement is that you're so drunk in public that you cannot care for yourself or somebody else. You can't be found drunk in your own home, but you have to be out in public or blocking a sidewalk. And the penalties are going to vary greatly based on which county it is and your record.
What would happen?
No record, clean.
What would happen in San Mateo County? Can you give us an idea?
In San Mateo County, if you pled guilty to drunk in public, a court handles the sentencing, not the district attorney's office. It could range from anywhere from 1 year to 2 years court probation and a fine. Again, every single case is different. If you just happen to be stumbling along a sidewalk, unable to care for yourself, it's different than... If you're...
That's the case. We're talking about where you can't care for yourself. You're a nice person, but you just messed up one time.
Do you have this facing you right now, Ann?
Do I have what?
Do you have this facing you or know of someone who's facing...
Yes, I do. I have someone who's facing it.
And in what...
Contra Costa County.
In Contra Costa?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My suggestion is you call the... And your friend does not have an attorney?
No.
Okay. And can your friend afford an attorney or is your friend...
Probably not.
Okay. So the if your friend pleads not guilty, am I correct on this or not? Would her friend get a public defender in Contra Costa County?
Yes. But however, a lot of drunken publics do not get referred necessarily to the district attorney's office. A lot of times police officers are trying to do the right thing for that individual and just make sure they're safe for the night, and that's the best way for them to do that.
This apparently hasn't happened
here. But the person has to appear, though.
If it was referred to the district attorney's office and they decide to file charges, yes. But usually for a first-time drunk in public in San Mateo County where nobody was injured and it's just a standard drunk in public, it'll be fines and usually not much jail time.
Go ahead, Kevin.
You're telling me there would be jail time?
No. Hold on, Ann, just a minute. Kevin, our CHP officer, wants to respond to you also.
Just a quick point in relation to your situation with DUIs. The drunk in public standard also applies to passengers in cars where the driver gets arrested DUI. If the person is, say, passed out in the front seat, and although they're both intoxicated, the driver was less intoxicated but still over the legal limit and was arrested, the passenger is obviously unable to take care of themselves. They would have to go for, because they are on a public
They'd be arrested also?
For public intoxication.
All right. You know, Ann, has your friend had to appear in court yet?
No.
All right. What your friend should do, just a suggestion, is be prepared. If your friend really feels there's some defense here, whether there is or is not, but wants to not just give in, probably the Contra Costa County Court will appoint a public defender for your friend. And as a matter of fact, I think, when's your friend to appear? How soon?
The end of the month. We're going to call you back on the 25th.
I bet you will. Here's my thought also on this, which might be helpful to your friend at this point. Is this the first-time offense?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you have your friend call the Contra Costa County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service?
Okay.
See if your friend can get an appointment with an attorney who does handle cases of being intoxicated in public, and have a half-an-hour consultation. Your friend will pay maybe $35. It's worth it, I think, to spend that kind of money to find out what the situation is.
Okay.
So good luck to you and your friend.
Thanks a lot.
And tell your friend not to do it anymore.
There you go.
Yeah. No more of this stuff. Okay, Ann, thank you very much. Grace, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, if a person is on the street with keys in their hand, and a cop is across the street, and the person clearly is intoxicated.
That's good.
What are their laws here? Because I know that actually happened to somebody in Florida, and he got a DUI.
No, there has to be observed driving.
The person has to be in the car.
Or evidence of driving.
In California.
There has to be some evidence of driving.
Yeah. So the intent to drive does not apply here.
No.
Okay.
But now, once the person opens the door to the car... Michael, once the person opens the door to the car, doesn't that get that person in trouble?
No.
Well, technically, I'll disagree with Kevin and Michael. They're being more liberal than I would be. In California, you can actually be charged for attempted drunk driving. That's Penal Code Section 664/Vehicle Code Section 23152A or B. It's possible. It's technically possible for a person to have taken steps more than mere preparation towards the drunk driving act, and that could be considered an attempt. It is so rarely even considered because of the inherent difficulties in proof and practicality that Kevin, have you ever seen anybody get busted on that theory?
I've heard of some people going down that road, but not successfully.
Right.
certainly, I would see that once that person opens the car door, gets in the car, and if that person has been stumbling, I would think that's a good basis, if a police officer saw that person, to apprehend that person.
Well, I think it would be wise for the police officer to apprehend and stop the person from doing it.
Right.
Whether or not that fulfills California's law of attempt is a much more
difficult thing to figure out. No, I agree. But I think in terms of protection of that person as
Absolutely.
Well as the public. Okay. Yeah, Michael, go ahead.
Look, it'd be great practice for the officer to detain that individual and make sure they're not going to drive. But also, if someone has had too much to drink and they refuse to take a cab, better than driving is to get in the car and sleep.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I agree. Get in the car and sleep. All right, last call. Srini, is that how I pronounce your name? Srini?
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air. You've got about half a minute for your question, if you would.
My question is, if you're inside a parking lot, you call your friend to get some money for the parking, is that considered an offense?
I didn't understand that at all. Say it again, would you?
I was inside a parking lot, and I didn't have money to pay the booth attendant, so I called my friend to send me some money with somebody. Well, and an officer stepped by, and he pulled me over, and he gave me a ticket for using a mobile phone while driving.
Oh, well, that's a different issue. That's the mobile phone. Yeah, if you're using a mobile phone while driving, that is in violation of California law. Thank you for calling. It was not relevant to the topic that we have. But, you know, Srini, maybe what you want to do is for our Call a Lawyer night in 2 weeks from now. Maybe you want to talk at some length with one of the attorneys for Call a Lawyer. It's 1-800-525-9917, and you'll have a chance to not be limited as we are right now. We have, by the way, come to the end of the program. I want to thank you very much for joining us. I want to wish you Happy New Year, not only to the guests on the program, but also to all of you out there. My guests have been San Mateo County Deputy District Attorney Michael Wendler. Michael, I'll probably see you tomorrow.
Yes, thank you.
Criminal Defense Attorney Jeffrey Carr, I'll see you at some time in the near future.
Next week or two.
Yeah. Jeff's office is in Redwood City, and California Highway Patrol Officer Kevin Walsh, who works out of the Redwood City CHP office.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, Chuck.
All right, next week, by the way, in case this is going to be a family law program, in case you have questions or problems or wonder what in the world is going on if you're facing a divorce, we're going to be talking about myths and common rumors about divorce. My guests will be family law attorneys Yasmin Mehmet and Mark Reza. They're both on the executive committee of the family law section of the State Bar of California. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Debbie Kennedy. Nice to have you with us, Debbie. Production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the San Mateo County Bar Association. Additional funding is provided by the Trusts and Estates section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and the California Applicants Attorneys Association. I hope you will join us next week. Thank you very much for listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney.
This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio, online at kalw.org. Coming up next at 8 o'clock, it's As It Happens from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Toronto. And at 9 o'clock, it's the Blues, it's the Fog City Blues, with your host, Devin Strolovich, for 2 hours. And then our rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call at 11 p.m. No calls, please, but your comments, of course, are welcome at feedback@yourcallradio.org. The time is 8 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Carol Off.
Good evening, I'm Jeff Douglas, and this is As It Happens. Tonight.
Trial separation. The Libyan government wants Muammar Gaddafi's son tried in Libya, but the International Criminal Court wants proof he'll be tried fairly.
Fuel for the fire. First, Nigeria was struggling to cope with ongoing sectarian violence, and then the demonstrations over gas prices began.
Botch and release. A month after a court stayed sex abuse charges against Fenwick McIntosh, people are demanding an inquiry into the failures that set him free.
Absent without leaf. Ontario's Environmental Commissioner warns that without greater protections, the province's maple trees are at risk of disappearing.
You could call them heels or arch villains. Whoever they are, the people who stole the biggest wooden shoe in the Netherlands ran a real clog and dagger operation.
And getting all high and mighty, man. A new study suggests smoking marijuana doesn't hurt your lungs and may possibly even make them a bit stronger. As It Happens, the Wednesday edition, Toke Radio.